Tonight's reading is taken from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 4 to 13. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate. You are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed.
Thank you, Rich. Please do keep that passage open. And if you're here for the first time, inside your service sheet is an outline of where we're going. The white sheet headed Better and Best. And pens are circulating. If you'd like a pen to take notes. Last week, we sung the hymn, It Is Well With My Soul, written by Horatio Spafford. And I was telling a little bit about the story then, that Spafford was a wealthy American lawyer who had a successful law practice in Chicago, and he was an elder in his church. And he had a wife, he had five children, and he had led a charmed life. Then in 1870, his four-year-old son died of scarlet fever. The following year, 1871, was the Great Chicago Fire, in which Spafford lost most of his money that he had invested in real estate. But he used what few resources he had left to show the love of Christ to those in need. His wife's health then began to fail, and so 2 years later, in 1873, he decided that they'd get a break and they planned a trip to Europe. And the idea was that they could also help the evangelists, Moody and Sankey, who were engaged in a mission in England. The day the Spaffords were due to set sail, an emergency came up at work in the law practice, and so Horatio sent his wife and four daughters on ahead, and he planned to follow a few days later. The steamer that his wife and daughters were on collided with another ship mid-Atlantic, and it sank within 12 minutes. Only 81 of the 307 on board survived. And when his wife got to the UK, she telegrammed her husband Horatio saying, saved alone. Spafford immediately set sail on another ship, and the captain let him know when they got to the spot mid-Atlantic where the other ship had gone down and where the water was 3 miles deep. And that night, alone in his cabin, Spafford wrote the words to this hymn, the famous hymn, It Is Well With My Soul. Subsequently, he reunited with his wife. They returned to Chicago. And 3 years later, they had another son, whom they also named Horatio. And like his brother before him, he too died at the age of 4 of scarlet fever. Why does God allow his people to suffer? Why doesn't he protect us from tragedies like this? I mean, given he's all-powerful, he's able to prevent it. And given he's all-loving, he should want to prevent it, or so we reason. So why doesn't he? And so maybe the doubts begin to creep in, that maybe God isn't all-powerful after all, or maybe he's not all-loving. Or is it simply that suffering is God's punishment for sin in our lives? How do we make sense of suffering? What is going on? It's an important question for all of us. You may be someone who has already gone through the mill as a Christian, or you may have lived a charmed life until now. But as surely as night follows day, at some point, suffering is going to hit all of us. So it's a question for us. It was a question as well for these Hebrew Christians to whom this letter was written. They had suffered for their faith, and they were weary of it. And because of it, some of them were in danger of giving up the faith and going back to Judaism. And it was vital that they understood suffering and the place it has in God's purposes. And that is the theme of the passage we just had read out. So Hebrews 12, 4 to 13. We ended last week with verse 3, which said, "Consider him, Jesus, who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted." And perhaps you're feeling worn down in the Christian life at the moment. Maybe you're becoming weary, you're becoming faint-hearted. How do we make sense of suffering? Three things we need. Firstly, the need for perspective. Verse 4, if you look at that, says, "In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood." So in your struggle against sin, and sin there could be a sinful world opposing you, or it could be the temptation to give up. In your struggle against sin, he says, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood, i.e., none of them had yet been martyred for their faith. Now, why does the writer say this? Well, his point is, what you have gone through for Christ is not actually that bad compared to what others have suffered. He's just mentioned Jesus, who in verse 2 endured the cross. And just before that, we read about those in chapter 11, verse 37, who it says were stoned, were sawn in two, and killed with a sword. Now that's quite something to say, isn't it, to a church who had been through what these Hebrew Christians had been through. We learn back in chapter 10, verse 32, that they had endured a hard struggle with suffering, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. You had compassion, he says, on those in prison. You joyfully accepted the plundering of your property. Life had not exactly been a walk in the park for these Christians. And we may feel reading that, well, I can quite understand why some of them might want to give up the faith. But the message to them is, what you've gone through actually ain't so bad compared to many others around the world and in church history. And you need to get some perspective on your situation. Now, if the writer said that to these Hebrew Christians, what would he say to us? Perhaps you're feeling weary because of opposition from your family, from friends, because you're a Christian. But it's not as if, the writer would say, it's not as if you face death threats for your faith, as many other believers have. And it's not as if you've even come close to being publicly flogged and beaten or losing your home for your faith, as these Hebrew Christians had, and as is the experience of many believers today. A sense of perspective is important. And especially for us as Christians in the West, who have it so easy, relatively. It's one reason I think why it's quite helpful to use a prayer diary like the ones produced by the Barnabas Fund or Open Doors, because it gives us perspective on our situation. Now, although the immediate issue here is suffering opposition for your faith, there's no reason why we can't apply this principle to suffering more generally. Ill health, job worries, even bereavement. That when hardship hits us, we need to get perspective. And a story like the Spaffords that I began with, it makes us aware, doesn't it, that other believers have gone through far more than us, and yet they have kept their faith. And for example, what believers in Syria are having to face at the moment, it puts our own trials in perspective, doesn't it? The theologian J.I. Packer writes this. He says, "This is a soft age in the West, an age in which ease and comfort are seen by the world as life's supreme values. Affluence and medical resources have brought people to the point of feeling that they have a right to a long life and a right to be free of poverty and pain for the whole of that life. And many even cherish a grudge against God and against society if these hopes do not materialize." We need to realize that Christians have never had it as good as we do today in the West. When things do go wrong in our lives, it's tempting, isn't it, to have a pity party? Feel like, woe is me, no one's ever had it as bad as me. Never was grief like mine, to change the words of that hymn. Never was grief like mine. You know, why is God allowing this? And we need to get perspective on our hardships. When our four-year-old loses one of his Playmobil pirate figures, his whole world collapses. And, you know, it's part of being a child, part of being 4 years old, that you lack perspective. Well, then as a teenager, your boyfriend or your girlfriend dumps you, and you want to end your life. You know, that is it. No point living. And it's a lack of perspective. But it's easy to slip into this later in life as well. On Friday morning, after my breakfast partnership group, a Bible study group I run here on the barge with some guys from the wharf at 7:30 in the morning, I had one of those moments when you're tempted to rail against God. Why this? You know, why me? Why now? My bicycle had a flat tire, and I had to walk home. Now, worse things have happened to me in my life so far than a flat tire, and there may be things you're going through at the moment that really are a lot more serious than that. But whatever it is, perspective is vital. Now, maybe you think the writer of Hebrews could do with a bit of pastoral counseling course. Maybe you think he's a little bit harsh, not very pastorally sensitive. Remember, he has actually said back in chapter 2, verse 18, that because Christ has suffered, he's able to help us when we're suffering. And he has already said in chapter 4, verse 17, that he's able to sympathize with our weakness. So he has said all that. And if someone in the church family shares a struggle with you, could I say this isn't saying your first response to them should be, you need to get a grip, you need to get some perspective. You know, what you're going through is nothing compared to what Christians in Syria are facing. That may not be the best first angle to go in at. You know, we do need to sympathize with one another, we do need to support one another. And we mustn't minimize the reality of suffering. So like this sort of stereotypical English soldier in the trenches in the First World War saying, you know, it's nothing, mustn't complain as he holds his leg that's just been blown off. We mustn't minimize suffering, but this is saying we do also need perspective. And secondly, we need to understand discipline. Discipline is the big theme in verses 5 to 11. A term comes up 8 times in these verses and nowhere else in the letter. Why is he talking about discipline here? Well, because he's trying to help them understand why they are suffering as they have been. And he's saying that suffering for the Christian, it is part of God's discipline of us. So our suffering, it's not random, it's not purposeless. It is something God uses to discipline us. Now, I don't know if that's a new thought to you. Maybe it's even a shocking thought. But it's something we need to get to grips with. So let's just break it down a bit. Firstly, we need to see that discipline is a mark of being a beloved child of God. Let me reread verse 5. It says, "Have you forgotten that exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father doesn't discipline? If you're left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons." So discipline, he says, is a sign that we are children of a loving heavenly Father. When God disciplines us, he's treating us as sons, as his beloved children. So, you know, as a father, I discipline my children because I love them. Likewise, this is saying our Heavenly Father disciplines us as his children. And one way he does that is by allowing suffering in all its shapes and forms in our lives. So the trials we face are part of God's loving discipline. Now, for some of us, that may be quite a new thought. So perhaps until now, when you've thought about being a child of God, you've thought of pleasant things like security, you know, being in the Father's hands, and protection and the intimacy of close relationship, Abba, Father, and the wonderful future you have as an heir with a heavenly inheritance, fellow heirs with Christ. All that is true, but this is saying that being a child also means discipline. That is part of the package, and it's actually a blessing. So for some of us, that may be a new thought. For some of us, that may be quite a difficult thought to take on board. So some here, I don't know, some here may have had a very negative experience of parental discipline as a child. So you may have been on the receiving end of very harsh treatment, which was anything but loving discipline. You know, just, it was just someone who was taking out on you their anger and their issues. So somebody told me that his childhood memories included, I remember being hit by my dad, an army boxing champion, until I cried, and then hit until I stopped, and I was 12 years old. Now, if you've been through anything like that, then this teaching here about discipline, it will need a lot of disinfecting, if I can put it that way. There is such a thing as loving discipline. In fact, love and discipline go hand in hand. The ideal father will discipline his children because he loves them, and God is that ideal father. Now, when we're going through trials, what are we tempted to think? We're tempted to think, God has fallen asleep on the job, or God has got it in for me, and God hates me, and he's rejected me. And this is saying it is actually the very opposite. Trials are part of his fatherly care. It is a sign that you are a true child of God. Now, does it mean that all the hardships I go through in my life as a Christian, they are all part of God's loving discipline of me? So when I get flu, if you get cancer, have a car crash, a relationship breakdown, depression, opposition, are these all part of God's loving discipline of me? I think the answer is yes, but we need to understand what discipline means. Now, this bit is really important, that when we think of discipline, what comes to mind? We think, don't we, of being punished for doing wrong. So, you know, a child does something naughty and gets disciplined by getting a smack or being told to sit on the stairs or whatever. And so we think, when we hear about God's discipline, we think, this must mean I have sinned and I am being punished for my sin. That is why I'm suffering like this. So everything that goes wrong in my life is God punishing me for sin. And if you go down that route, you must conclude that the greater the suffering, presumably the greater the sin I'm being punished for. Now that is not right. If that were true, it would mean that the suffering the Hebrew Christians went through was punishment for sin. But that was patently not the case. The reason that they had suffered being insulted and beaten and prison and lost their possessions wasn't for sin, it was because they stood up for Christ. If this were true, it would mean that the Syrian Christians who are suffering at the moment are worse sinners than us because they're suffering a lot more than we are. And of course, this is precisely the mistake that Job's friends fell into. They assumed Job was being punished for sin, when in fact we know there was no one more righteous on earth than Job in God's sight. So discipline is not punishment for wrongdoing. It can involve that. It can involve that. And there is, for example, 1 Corinthians 11:30 is an example of that. But discipline is much broader than that biblically. The word translated in this passage, discipline, is translated in other verses in the Bible as to instruct and to teach and to educate and to train. So it's a much broader idea than just punishment. And we actually use it in this broader sense when we talk of discipline in a family. So in our family, for example, discipline, it does mean that on occasion we give the kids a hard time for doing wrong. But it is much, much more than that. So discipline is about not just giving them what they want all the time, but what is best for them long term. So if it was just up to our kids, I guess they would happily spend the whole day playing Temple Run or Angry Birds on the iPad. All day. And part of discipline is we don't allow them to do that. Not all day, anyway. They need to do some homework, need to help out with the chores, and do other things. And part of discipline is that they can't just eat ice cream and sweets all day, as they would choose to if they had half a chance, but they need to eat other stuff as well that they don't like so much. Yes, there are limits, there are parameters. And discipline within a family, it may even include allowing them some rope to do things that they want to do and then suffering the consequences and learning the hard way. That's part of discipline. And so when you put all this together, we could say that life for them is harder and not as pleasant as the ideal life that they would choose. Because the ideal life they would choose is a life of uninterrupted iPad and ice cream. Now, do we treat them like this because we don't love them? Well, no, of course, we impose this discipline because we do love them and we want what is best for them. We don't want them growing up into spoilt brats. And so with our loving Heavenly Father. What we experience as discipline, He allows and He uses to train us and to shape us and to teach us as children of God. So yes, in that sense, all suffering that we experience could be said to be part of God's loving discipline. But we need to get away from thinking of discipline purely as punishment for sin. That sort of connection all the time is unbiblical, and pastorally it is a complete disaster. I mean, to go back to the Spafford family I mentioned at the beginning, they actually ended up leaving their church and leaving their country and going to start a new life in Jerusalem. And one reason they did that was they got so fed up of being told that the tragedies that they had experienced were divine punishment. So Horatio's daughter wrote of her father later on, "All around him, people were asking the unvoiced question, what guilt had brought this sweeping tragedy to them? And it was to bring father into conflict with what was then the Christian world." The other thing to say is that we mustn't be simplistic about suffering. So discipline is not the only reason for suffering as believers. There may be many reasons why God allows suffering in the lives of His children. And I want to just quote a passage from Don Carson. He's written extensively on this whole issue of suffering. There's one passage I found particularly helpful. He says, "In any suffering, or indeed any other event for that matter, God is doubtless doing many things, perhaps thousands of things, millions of things, even if we can only detect one or two or three or a handful. So a godly woman in her middle years is diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. What is God doing? My little brain," he says, "can imagine several possibilities. At one level, he may be providentially allowing the effluence of the fall to take their course, a constant reminder that it is appointed for all of us to die and then face judgment. He may be preparing her for eternity. It is a great grace to know that you are going to die and to prepare for it. Or he may be shocking her 20-something son, who is living his life indifferent to the gospel, to prod him into self-examination and repentance. And he may use her testimony about the joy of the Lord, even in the midst of suffering, to call another of her children into vocational ministry. He may be using her as a way to teach people in her church what it looks like to die well, anticipating several other deaths in the next 2 years. He may be teaching her minister husband to slow down and to care about his family and, in principle, other people, instead of being endlessly busy with the ministry. He may be sparing her from living long enough to witness the moral destruction of her daughter. Her funeral may be the means by which several of her unconverted relatives for whom she has been praying will come to faith, conversions for which she would happily give her life. Perhaps one of those converts will become a Christian pastor of rare gift, whose ministry of proclamation will touch thousands. Perhaps she is hiding some deep bitterness and hate in her life, and God is using this means to confront her. He says, I've barely started a list of possible things God may be doing, and I have a small brain. I think he means small in relation to God's rather than ours. What does the omniscient God think he is doing? In other words, sometimes we have to cover our mouths and confess in faith that we cannot possibly grasp all that God is doing when someone suffers. So why should we think in antithetical terms about how God must be doing this but not that, when in reality he may be doing this and that and that and that and so on? Now, it's a long quotation, but I think he just puts it brilliantly well. Now, if I have this perspective on suffering, that it is part of loving discipline, it will change my response to it and also to God. So if you look at verse 9, it says, besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? When we're suffering, we're tempted, aren't we, to rebel against God and to rail against God? But if we understand this issue of loving discipline, we can submit ourselves to God as our Father and submit ourselves to his good and loving purpose in this suffering. And it means we're even able to do what James 1 talks about when it says in verse 2, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. And that is what these Hebrew Christians had been doing in times past. They had joyfully accepted the confiscation of their property. There's one film by the Swedish director Ingmar Bergman, which is called Summer Interlude. If you think of a Hollywood feel-good film and then think of the exact opposite, you're getting fairly close. In it, this girl called Marie loses her sweetheart in a diving accident. And she rages against God. She says, I don't believe God exists. And if he exists, I hate him. And I shan't stop hating him. And if he was standing before me, I'd spit in his face. I'll hate him as long as I live. I shan't forget. I'll hate him until I die. Now that is how we are tempted to respond when we're suffering. But as Christians, we need to turn to God as our loving Heavenly Father, and we need to accept what is happening as part of his loving purpose for us. When I was a child, I remember writing one of those letters that I think most kids write at some stage to their parents, saying, I hate you. I'm leaving home. I've had enough. And by the time you read this, I'll be long gone. And, you know, in fact, you get as far as the gate at the bottom of the garden before you think, actually, this is pretty cold and stupid. It's just part of rebelling against constraint as a child, isn't it? And not realizing that actually they're being loving. And part of growing up is understanding that. And that is part of maturing as believers as well. That we don't just throw the toys out of the pram when things don't work out as we want. I was reading about a woman called Mabel. Mabel is a blind, deaf, disease-ridden, cancerous old lady who is aged 89. She's been bedridden in a nursing home for 25 years. And when she was asked what she thought about as she passed her lonely days and nights, she said this, I think about Jesus. I think about how good he has been to me. He's been awfully good in my life. He's all the world to me. Now that is a mature faith, isn't it? And that is the kind of faith that understands that discipline of suffering is ultimately for our good. As verse 10 says, for they, that is earthly fathers, disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to them. But he, that is God, disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Imagine you could go online and you could place an order for life as you wanted your life to be. What would you order? How many years? 90 years? Yeah, we'll go for 90 years. Of what? Health? Yes, we'll have that. Happiness? Yes. Ease? Yes. Comfort? Yes. Wealth? Yes. Suffering? No. I think we'll leave that box unchecked. Trouble? No. Difficulty? No. God has got a much bigger and better plan for our lives. His goal is our good. And our good is what? Well, the verse says that we may share his holiness. That we become more Christ-like. That our lives are filled with the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And ultimately, that we live eternally, as the end of verse 10 says. That is the agenda that the Lord is working to. Now, as a father, I often make mistakes. You know, I try to do what is best for my kids. I often get it wrong. But God, by contrast, he gets it right every time. It says he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. That will not happen without the discipline of suffering. God uses hardships to shape us as his people, to make us into the people we are created to be. Do you remember that verse in Romans 5, verse 3? It says, we rejoice in our sufferings. Why? Knowing that suffering produces, do you remember how it goes on, endurance. And endurance produces character, and character produces hope. So even when it's just a flat tire on your bicycle, it's a bit of a test, isn't it? It's a chance to say, well, Lord, this is not what I would have chosen. You know, I'm going to have to walk home now, and I'm going to be behind with my work for the rest of the day. But, you know what is best. Please use this for my good. Please teach me something through this. Make me more Christ-like. Use this for your purposes. And walking home, I think you probably did teach me a bit of patience. And I saw things I wouldn't have seen if I was speeding past on my bicycle. And I ended up bumping into someone I needed to speak to and I hadn't been able to get hold of and so on. And I don't see that as God punishing me for some sin. But it is always good when you're facing suffering of whatever kind, it's always good to examine ourselves and to say, what can I learn from this? Now, it's a completely trivial example. I'm aware of that. But the principle is important because it remains the same as you move up the levels of suffering. The principle remains exactly the same. Verse 11 says, for the moment all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. That word trained there is a word from athletics. It's from the gym. Training, as a lot of you know, a lot of gym bunnies here, I'm sure, training is often painful, often unpleasant, but it's necessary, isn't it? If you want to get fitter, if you want to win races, what's the mantra? No pain, no gain. And so I need to see God, if you like, as my personal trainer. God as my coach. If you see a trainer who's putting an athlete through some painful exercises, would you say, oh, the trainer's being cruel, he's being sadistic? Well, no, we understand, don't we? He wants the very best for the athlete. He wants them to win. And it's the same with God and us, that he is training us as our people for our spiritual, eternal good. The other day, I got on the phone to cancel my subscription to The Week magazine. I've been on one of these trial periods where you get 50 copies for a 50p or something ridiculous. I actually came off the phone with a subscription to Men's Fitness. 5 issues for £1 each. I'm such a sucker for telephone marketing. I think partly it's I feel so sorry for these people trying to sell this stuff as their job. So anyway, I came off the phone with a subscription to Men's Fitness. On page 35, it says this. Sprints are hard. They hurt. There'll be moments of doubt in the middle of a sprint workout. You mustn't give in. By pushing through the physical discomfort and pain, you will build a lean, muscular body. Well, I didn't do any of the sprints because I was inside at the time, but they had some leg exercises they're recommending, so I did those. For the next 3 days, I could hardly get down the stairs, and I was sort of walking around like I just got off a horse. But I'm going to stick with it, because I want to look like that guy on the front cover. Now, don't be mean. I know. When you become a Christian, you become a member of God's gym, and you get God as your personal trainer. And his goal is to get you spiritually fit and mature and holy. His goal is to get you to heaven and to the new world beyond. And that is going to involve training, not life as a beach. Therefore, verse 12, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint but rather healed. If you've been feeling weary in the Christian life, don't give up. If you're slowed down in the Christian race because things are hard and life has got painful, understand what God is up to and pick up the pace. Lift those drooping hands and press on. Run straight ahead towards the goal. Make straight paths, it says, for your feet. So not going off-piste in disobedience, but run straight ahead towards the goal. And be looking around for others who are flagging so you can encourage them too. So when it says in verse 13, what is lame, it's probably referring to individuals in the church who were in danger of giving up. They were spiritually hobbling. They were injured. And it's saying that as believers, we have a responsibility to care for one another, to bind up the sprained ankles so that people can get back up to speed, get back in the race. Mark Twain said, "You don't have to be faster than the bear. You just have to be faster than the slowest guy running from the bear." I.e., you know, then the other guy will be eaten, not you. So you don't have to be faster than the bear, you just have to be faster than the slowest guy running from the bear. That is a sort of very every man for himself mentality, isn't it? Now, that is not the Christian way. There's another saying which goes, these are all American sayings, by the way, a herd of buffalo is only as fast as the slowest buffalo. And that is a more Christian perspective. That we are in a team game in which the goal is to get the whole team across the finish line, not just yourself. So is there someone you could be looking out for? Is there someone who's hobbling, sprained ankle, even lying face down on the track? Why not go and give them a hand and get them back on their feet and help them to get back up to speed? We're going to pause now, have a few moments for quiet and for prayer. And then when the music starts, we're going to stand, we're going to sing this song which picks up what we've been thinking about. In particular, the third verse you'll see is about our response to suffering. It's saying, "Teach me humbly to receive the sun and the rain of your sovereignty. Each strand of sorrow has a place within this tapestry of grace. So through the trials I choose to say, your perfect will in your perfect way." But let's pray first.